the All Things XR podcast. Where you can get the best AR/VR analyzers from the biggest names in the field. Hi everyone, welcome to the All Things XR podcast, I'm Mojtaba. In today's episode, we talk about AR and VR in entertainment and media with David Johnston, lead producer at BBC. Hi, David.
How's it going, Mojtaba?
Thanks very much. Can you tell us more about yourself and how did you come to work in AR and VR?
Yeah, great. So I'm currently working at the BBC as a lead producer, looking at kind of emerging formats, and that includes VR and AR. I started my career in film post-production back in the beginning of the millennium in 2000-2001. And, you know, that kind of area at the time was undergoing some really big changes around kind of capture and post-production, which led me into 6 or 7 years of consultancy, looking at technology for creative purposes, basically. So for film or advertising. Towards the end of that period, a lot of my clients were getting quite interested because the DK1 had just come out from Oculus, and they were looking at using it for installations or maybe kind of creative content. Ever since, really, I've been working in this field. So I worked on a couple of projects, one for Sony PSVR, one for Oculus Starry Studio, and that led me here to the BBC to investigate using VR and AR for creative content, as well as kind of production tooling within the broadcast industry, and kind of supporting the UK as a whole in this area as well.
Mm-hmm. Great. So can you tell us what you do in daily basis at BBC, and how do you think that AR and VR does its role in such a giant corporation?
Yeah, so I think my day-to-day is it depends, really. There isn't really a kind of common day. It's a lot of my job is helping people do their jobs, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of facilitation, it's a bit of project management, it's a lot of, you know, you mentioned the BBC is a really big organization. A lot of it is getting people to talk to each other, getting people to kind of speak the same language, or it's going out into the wider organization or the wider industry and talking about this kind of technology, talking about, you know, what we're doing at the BBC, what they could be doing externally. So there really isn't a kind of a common day. I like to keep my hand in the kind of practical side of it as well. So I like to make things. So, you know, when new AR kit stuff comes out, you know, I kind of jump into Xcode and look at the code samples and see what's possible. So when we're talking to colleagues or partners that we might want to do things with, I know that what I'm promising we can do is something that's actually practical given the state of technology. Because, you know, as you know, a lot of these technologies have been around for quite a long time in one form or another, but what you can actually achieve with them today or in 2 or 3 weeks is kind of different sometimes to what people claim is possible, right? Like, maybe we'll get there one day, but we're not there yet, I think. Yeah, so I mean, I can speak pretty generally about the broadcast and creative industries in the UK. I think, you know, VR certainly offered a really interesting opportunity to explore new forms of storytelling. And I'm gonna try and not say storytelling too much because it's a pretty overused word. Yeah. But you know, entertainment or narrative or documentary or education, it offered a really good opportunity for people to explore new ways of doing that. And I think because there's certainly with a lot of the initial interest was around 360 capture for kind of obvious reasons, because there's a really big overlap between the core competency of making video for news or for TV and shooting 360 video, right? The output is basically the same. There's some technical constraints around lenses and post-production, but I think a lot of broadcasters and a lot of media companies jumped onto that 360 thing quite early and was reasonably successful in kind of finding areas that it was relevant to their business. And that led for a lot of organizations, so the BBC, Sky, NBC, you know, Wall Street Journal, NYT, Guardian, a lot of those organizations then turned to interactive VR because they realized that 360 video had some constraints, shall we say. You know, there's no there's very little interactivity.
Exactly.
And I think that has been really good, actually, because what it's done is kind of through a Trojan horse brought an awareness of the necessary skill sets to do interactive narrative in one form or another. You know, whether we talk about games, whether we talk about interactive video of some form, whether we talk about VR or AR or future formats, you know, the skill set to make them is, there's a lot of commonality. So a lot of it is game engine technology. A lot of it is 3D asset creation. And up to now, a lot of broadcasters haven't necessarily had to skill up for that or hire in for that because, you know, making TV is quite a well-known process. You know, you shoot some stuff, you edit some stuff, you get some motion graphics or visual effects done, you do your audio mix, you put it all together and you package it. And so I think it's been really interesting how a lot of media companies and broadcasters particularly have had to look at these different skill sets and how they can kind of adapt their current teams around them.
So, David, what do you see as the current state of AR and VR in the entertainment sector?
Yeah, that's a really good question, isn't it? I think to my point earlier about the initial rush of interest and the excitement around 360 and interactive, I think the consumer base has not been forthcoming in a way that, you know, broadcasters want viewership in the millions, and headset ownership globally is likely only the kind of low millions, right? I think that's a generally accepted kind of number right now. And the flip side of it is making stuff for VR. Let's focus on VR briefly.
Yeah.
Just for now. It's quite expensive, right? Like, especially if you don't have workflow and staff who can make assets and create content using those technologies, it's quite an expensive thing to invest in. And so you still see some companies investing in it. So, you know, movie companies still use it as a kind of marketing tool, I think. There's a lot of LBE that's still happening, which is really exciting. For a broadcast like the BBC, I think, or let's say Sky or other broadcasts in the UK, I think it's a fine balance of kind of keeping an interest in this area and keeping enough expertise within the organization or available to the organization so that if and when VR becomes a bigger thing, then they can kind of grow a team back to create content or services using the technology. So that's kind of where I think it is now, right now in the UK, at least in terms of media entertainment. I think there's opportunities for, obviously, I think gaming is the thing we're not talking about, and that's hopefully a given, where gaming and VR are a really good fit and people are making money, and, you know, it's one of the focuses of the kind of two or three main players in the VR industry. When it comes to something like AR, it's much harder to see. I think, you know, something like mobile AR, I think there's a lot of opportunity, but there's no, you know, because of the user base is huge, you know, it's billions, it's probably hundreds of millions of people, probably a billion people who can access this stuff because of things like AR kit and AR core. And it's reasonably simple to develop for if you are used to mobile development or if you've done kind of Unity or Unreal development before. The difficulty appears to be, and I think this is probably across the board, not just for broadcasters or entertainment companies, is finding content formats or use cases that really feel like they need to be in AR and aren't just that kind of novelty piece. Right now, as of kind of today, I haven't seen a huge amount of kind of hit applications that are really kind of growing. And the difficulty is, right, is that we all hope, we all think that the technology is going in one direction. And this is a lot of really solid building blocks to get there. But the kind of the proofs of concept of that direction, things like Magic Leap for consumer, I guess, and HoloLens in the kind of enterprise, and, you know, Unreal and all these other devices, they're not consumer ready yet. And what for end user content, for audience facing content, what broadcasters need to think about is who has this hardware available to them so they can deliver that content, and how do we deliver it to those audiences? And so again, that's slightly difficult. I think what's really interesting is the possibility of using these technologies for making content, though, for production, right? So there's a rise in things like virtual production in the film industry, you know, everyone's been talking about The Mandalorian and Lion King, but it happens kind of across the board and across the budget as well. It's taking advantage of the fact that we now have very cheap tracked cameras in mobile phones, or, you know, using something like the Vive trackers to track cameras and place them in a kind of 3D space.
Exactly.
And then being able to augment that. I think that's really, really exciting. You know, there's still barriers and blockers there, but it's that we've got across that threshold of it costing £100,000 for a full tracked camera setup because of this investment in VR. And it's quite funny, really, because the reason that consumer VR came about in the first place, you know, in the last 10, 15 years, is because of the investment in phone screens, right, and in gyroscopes in mobile phones. So it's kind of it's quite a nice kind of little partnership where technology in one area really augments technology in another area.
Exactly. So, David, one of the most famous AR installations was for BBC Frozen Planet, which I think Andy did it, where you could see yourself with dolphins, whales, and all kinds of Arctic animals. And how does BBC think about the use of AR and VR in its future?
I am not sure I can answer that question on behalf of the organization, but... you know, the Frozen Planet installation you're referring to was a kind of marketing piece around a natural history show that was done by one of our partners for a commercial show.
Exactly.
I think it's really interesting that you kind of mentioned that, because it's a really good example of how the technologies that we call AR and VR, XR really, is such a wide gamut, right? That was something where people could go into a shopping mall or a museum and they could interact with this kind of virtual content on a screen or a wall. They didn't have to wear any special technology. It was kind of social, it was participatory. And that is, to me, is a really exciting area of this technology that you can do right now. And you can get huge numbers of people through it because you don't require specialist technology above and beyond the thing itself, right? The setup for a room.
Mm-hmm.
And it allows people to have these kind of like normal human social interactions within this space. That's not to say that, you know, social in VR or AR isn't really interesting. It's just that it's such a kind of low barrier to entry to go into these spaces. And I think we see that more and more, right? I think there's been quite a lot of installations over the last few years, be it for marketing or for art or for education, that use these spaces, use projection mapping, you know, maybe they use quite light touch technology or computer vision of some kind to do kind of participatory immersive experiences. And I think that's really interesting. I think it's a really exciting area to think about broadcasters and media be able to play in. Now, obviously, a lot of broadcasters, you know, if we take broadcasters as a category, what they're trying to do on the whole is get content or services to the user where they are, like in their home or on a mobile device. What these things are kind of not scalable in a kind of taking that and put it in your home right now, but they are, you can certainly get access to more people because it's just a space, right? And I think that's an interesting area to think about. You know, what does it mean to be a entertainment or content company when you can use public spaces or kind of like public/private spaces as opposed to delivering content to people's homes? So it's not just, it's about getting people to come to your location-based experience. And it doesn't have to be a headset thing. It doesn't have to be a kind of Magic Leap thing. It can just be a space that you've adapted, you know, like immersive theatre is a huge thing in the UK.
Exactly.
And it has been for kind of 15, 20 years. And I think that's growing across the world. Things like escape rooms are really exciting. And they are really, you know, they're at their heart an immersive experience. They just happen to not rely on high technology. It's all about the kind of design and stuff. So there's so much crossover in this field that it's a really interesting time to be working in it.
Uh-huh. So speaking of AR installations, some of the broadcasters like Weather Channels embrace those very well and have used them very well. What do you think about those use cases?
So are you referring to the kind of the virtual production thing with the Weather Channel where you could see the sea levels rising and that kind of thing?
Exactly.
Yeah, I think that's really, you know, it's a massive change in the way that people can make content, I think. Mm-hmm. You know, that access to cheap, or in some cases free, but, you know, let's say cheap technology that allows you to do high-end camera tracking, high-end rendering, you know, real-time rendering. You can change graphics on the fly. You're not reliant upon quite expensive, quite old systems for doing visualizations and graphics. I think that is for, let's say, for filmmakers, for example, mm-hmm. or for people trying to get into this space, you know, social media, people like people doing TikToks or people doing Instagrams or Snapchat. And you can see it on things like TikTok and Snapchat right now,
yeah.
where people are doing this stuff using the tools that are available to them within those platforms. And they are just as interesting, probably more interesting because they're, you know, they're at the cutting edge of kind of culture than the things that people do with really old school kind of broadcast technology. The Weather Channel is really exciting because it's so glossy and American and high end, right? But in terms of making those tools available to more people, I think it's really exciting that we're at this time where we have tools that people can carry around in their pocket to make films. And they're not just, you know, it's the camera, it's the microphone, and then it's all the tools that used to be available only to people on $100 million budgets. Mm-hmm. But now you can do it with a $2 app. Like, it's kind of unbelievable that we've come so far in my career, which has only been 20 years, where it used to, you know, it would literally be cost you hundreds of thousands of pounds to do some of the things that you can do in Snapchat. And now you can do it for free. Like, exactly. it's loopy. And that's really exciting. It just means, like, it's kind of hard to imagine what people will do with these formats. You know, if you go on Instagram, there is a lot of people using Instagram and the tools of Instagram, like mm-hmm. Spark AR to create filters, yeah. that are making kind of, they're not doing it for, obviously they're making it for quote unquote content, but they're kind of creating art with it, right? It's the kind of adaptability of things like Spark and Snapchat Studio, Lens Studio and the other tools available on social platforms mean that, yeah, you can make cool masks to promote your TV show, but there's also this wealth of free tools available to creators. And that's really exciting from a kind of creative point of view.
Yeah, exactly. Other than these AR effects, I think democratizing these tracking tools will also have a huge effect in creating high-end VFX and AR and VR content. For example, these days you can create a Hollywood quality scene with just a few HTC Vive sensors and create an immersive scene. What do you think about democratization of these tools and how this will affect media and entertainment businesses?
Yeah, I totally agree. 100% agree with exactly what you just said there. I think what's interesting is that the access and the cost of making all forms of content basically has gone down mm-hmm. in magnitudes over the past kind of 20, 30 years. You know, if you think back to the early 90s, no one could afford to shoot on film. You could shoot on VHS camera, but it was terrible. To edit it, you needed like a double deck VCR recorder or whatever. And these days, you as a person with a mobile phone, or maybe, I don't know, like $1,000, can go out and buy a camera that, for all intents and purposes, is as good as a Hollywood camera. As in, you know, you can get some very nice glass, you can shoot at similar resolutions. Yeah, it's not going to be exactly the same as shooting video and, you know, shooting like on a digital Arri camera or something. But in terms of practically, it's just as good. And I think the same, like you said, with the tracking technology means that you can do high-end studio visual effects, you can do high-end camera tracking, and the fidelity of that track, the fidelity of those graphics is just as good as you could achieve on a high budget film. Now, the difference, of course, is that if you're spending millions on visual effects or millions on a production, a lot of that money ends up on the it ends up on the screen, right? It goes to the uh-huh. production value of the content itself rather than the technology. But the technology was such a huge barrier that if you have very little budget, you get to spend all that budget on the screen now, whereas previously you would have spent all that budget getting hold of some hardware to do the camera tracking or the lenses or, you know, or whatever it is that we're talking about. And so what's exciting being in the creative industries generally, and I'll bring this back to XR in a minute, but I think generally is that you look at something like YouTube mm-hmm. and the good content on, I mean, obviously YouTube is full of, you know, there's a lot of nonsense on YouTube because yeah. it's just everything, isn't it? Everything's on YouTube.
Yeah.
But the really high-end content is, it's indistinguishable from high-end, some of it is indistinguishable from kind of high-end TV in certain genres, high-end education content, high-end animation. And I think most of that is down to the fact that the barrier to entry is so low with kind of all tools these days from a kind of from a quote-unquote TV film perspective, as well as all these other kind of areas we're talking about, you know, VR and AR as a kind of art form in and of itself, that all you need is an idea and a bit of a will to go out there and learn some tools these days. You don't have to, there's no financial barrier to entry. And that's just super exciting that people with like cool ideas, kids with cool ideas basically can just dive in and start making things. And I think that's been a trend over, you know, over the past 20, 30 years. And you can see that it's happened much quicker on this iteration with things like VR and AR. We haven't had to wait 100 years for people to be able to make films. You know, we've had to wait 10 years for people to get access to kind of really high-end visual effects tools in the form of things like Instagram, right? And Instagram filters and Facebook filters. Like whatever you think of the large technology giants, they have change the nature of what it means to be able to create content by providing tools and technologies and platforms. And there's downsides to that, right? Obviously, there's downsides to that. But I think the upsides are kind of transformative for people who want to make creative content. And that's really exciting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Speaking of AR broadcast installations, have you seen the AR installations on sports events? What do you think about those?
Yeah. So you mean as someone at home watching on TV, or do you mean someone in the stadium?
Yeah, both of them.
Yeah. So I mean, at home, you know, I think there's two parts to that. One is that there's a kind of really flashy, high-end production value thing, which, you know, sports shows like to put a lot of production value on the screen, because ultimately watching people run around on a pitch kicking a ball, although, you know, emotionally exciting, isn't that visually exciting, yeah. I think. But it's really interesting. I think there's some interesting, especially things like, you know, I don't watch much sport, but American football, where, you know, you need to know distances and how far you are in yards from certain lines. I think that's really useful because you can show people and that it gives them a better understanding of the sport. I think in the stadium piece, you know, there's been a few examples of this over the last few years in Korea and in America. I think they're exciting, and you know, they feel a bit like a kind of an evolution of that halftime show where it's all about the spectacle and it's all about novelty. I do wonder, you know, how well that technology currently holds up at scale, as in the amount of people in stadiums. I don't know the answer to that. I've never been in one of those stadiums to try this technology. But I'm not aware of, let's say, any wireless technologies that hold up really well when you've got that many people on them. But that's, you know, I'm sure that's just an implementation detail.
Yeah.
And then, you know, into the future, there's the possibility of people being able to wear, let's say, glasses or goggles in sports stadiums or in a theater. And I think there's a kind of long history of that, right, where you go to see the opera and you have surtitles, or you've got glasses so you can see people on stage, or you're at a cricket match in the UK, and a lot of people at cricket matches listen to commentary on radios rather than, you know, the commentary isn't kind of live in the stadium. They've got a radio piece in. I think that just feels like a really interesting evolution of that. Like, how do we use technology to help people better understand the thing that they're doing? And sport's good because it's rule based, it's well contained. People love it, right? Like it's always one of the things that comes up when there's new innovative technology. Like, how can we apply it to sport? Because sport is such a big sector. And people when they go to sports teams, kind of willing to try new things because it's part of their routine, right? They go and see the same team every other week or whatever.
Yeah. The marketing of these installations are not very honest, though. They usually portray them as if everyone in the stadium, for example, can see a dragon flying around with naked eyes. But the reality is that it is just a fixed angle and is only viewable in the displays of that specific area.
I mean, there's definitely a disconnect, isn't there, between the marketing of XR as a technology for experiences and the reality. I think that's a really big challenge for the industry. You know, if you look at the stuff that Magic Leap kind of distributed early on in their kind of tenure, a lot of that wasn't really living up to the reality of the technology right now.
Exactly.
And I think it's hard to manage that. And sure, for like commercial companies, they want to create buzz, they want to create investment, but there's a possibility of overselling technology to people. Certainly I've found in my career where people have been like, oh yeah, I've heard of this technology. I've seen this video, I've spoken to this person, they said it can do X, Y, and Z. And you're like, well, I mean, technically what you're saying is true, but the reality is that, you know, it's very different, right? When you actually have to do the thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Speaking of Magic Leap, a few years ago, Magic Leap developed an app for the new season of Game of Thrones with its headsets. And I think more and more of entertainment giant players are considering AR and VR for their promotions. What do you think about that use case?
Yeah, I think it's, you know, people you, there's a long kind of happy history of companies using new technologies, especially kind of visual, audiovisual technologies to market their broadcast technology. And I think, you know, the Game of Thrones one you refer to, there's been a couple, hasn't there? There was the original Game of Thrones one at South by Southwest, which was the elevator, the DK1 or the DK2 in an elevator. And then since there's been the Magic Leap piece. And I think it's really, yeah, I think it's great. I think anything that we can do to raise awareness of the technology is great. And certainly kind of being a sidecar to something like Game of Thrones or the Avengers or big, you know, broadcast shows is a good way to do that. In terms of the flip side, which is like how useful are they for the audience, the show? I mean, you know, they're cool and they're fun and they're novel. And I expect to see kind of more and more of this as we go down this kind of path of technology advancing.
One of the things that I think will affect entertainment and media as we know it is volumetric videos, of course, if we can record and play them efficiently. Do you see potential in those forms of media?
Yes, yeah, I do. I think you kind of hit the nail on the head a little bit, which is, you know, at the really cutting research edge of let's say volumetric capture or light field capture, there is some really compelling kind of demonstrations of what might be possible in the future. But, you know, so like, I think the really good examples of this are Facebook avatar, codec avatars, like Paul Debevec's work in light stage capture. So he's working at Google now on light fields. And there's a couple of other teams working in this area. And what's achievable when money and time is no object is incredible. The reality of that for a consumer right now is a little bit different, I think. You know, there was a big boom, I want to say maybe 3 or 4 years ago, in companies working in the kind of volumetric space. You had Microsoft's kind of cutting edge research in volumetric capture. There was AI in New Zealand. There's been a couple of companies, one of which was bought by Intel, who were working in this kind of either like dense multi-view or volumetric capture. Now, those technologies have come a long way, and you know the results are pretty good. But at the end of the day, what you end up with is kind of an animated 3D model with a diffuse texture, or a diffuse texture and maybe some kind of other maps that you've generated. And it's quite hard to see how, like, what the use cases for those are right now. You know, we've done, within teams I've worked at, you know, both here and other places, there's been demonstrations of taking those volumetric captures and, let's say, putting them on a table. What does that add to, you know, what does that add to the experience that you're trying to create? It's a little hard to see. I think, you know, there's good use cases for VR, but it's still, you still have to have a good story. You still have to have good art direction that mixes the real and the kind of unreal. You've still got to think about like why you're doing it. I worked on a project with a team here in London that was for Sony, which was a project called Joshua Bell, which was a violinist performance that's released on PSVR. And, you know, that was a similar kind of, there was a challenge, like we want to represent this real person in VR and we want it to not just be a 360 video. And the solution we came up with is, you know, we could have, you know, the team could have gone away and shot volumetric video and all this kind of thing. But really what the solution was kind of going back to that kind of classic stereography solution, which is having, you know, two different views for the eyes and this kind of thing. And the feeling of reality was so much more than we could get for volumetric video back then, and probably even now, actually. And so it's one of those areas where you're like, yeah, this is a really cool research area, but apart from a bit of novelty and some kind of quite specific use cases, again, it's like a let's wait and see, shall we? You know, I think there's going to be a time in the future where this stuff is so good that we can use it for filming actors that are dead, right? Or that want to be in two places at once, or you know, the world of digital doubles and visual effects is photorealistic right now, but to get there, it takes a lot of time and money. And to the earlier point, maybe that the access to that technology from a cost and kind of barrier to entry point of view will come down, and it'll be easier to capture people, and everyone will be able to have their own digital doubles that you can shoot and repose and create visual effects with. But it doesn't feel like we're there just yet. It's quite hard to see because of the limitations of things like physics, when we will get there or what technology might be available to get us there. It feels like it's going to have to be a mix of kind of consumer technology plus things like generative networks, rather than the current solutions. A lot of the current solutions which just rely on lots of cameras, and then, you know, a combination of computer vision and machine learning to create, you know, whatever the solution is, a model or some kind of like mix of character and software.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, I totally agree. Yeah. So
I think it's super interesting. It's just one of those things where you can't. There's a lot of steps that still have to be solved, I think.
Yeah. I totally agree. I think eventually we will spend more and more time of our lives in simulated worlds, in something like VR, something like Oasis, like future. Considering the limitless nature of these worlds, what potentials do you see for entertainment in that future?
I think people like to not just have, there's kind of two modes of entertainment and interaction. I think one of them is I want to watch or hear or read something that somebody else has kind of created wholly, and my involvement in it is a participant, right? So novels, mm-hmm. or theater, or you know, going to the movies, that's still a really, I think, still a really valuable and enjoyable experience. And there's kind of no suggestion that has changed culturally. What has changed, I think, or rather what has come back around again, is the possibility of things being interactive and participatory. So, you know, immersive theatre or video games are a really good example of this, because, you know, they're such a huge industry now. And so in the future, it feels like it's just going to be an expansion of this space where you can totally have a creative career where you are making that, let's say, doesn't have to be a linear narrative, but you're making that crafted experience for someone who can experience it, and they come away and they've got value and they talk about it with their friends. And then there's a kind of spectrum all the way through to like super personalized, super interactive experiences. But they all take, you still have, they all have to be crafted in some way, shape or form by experienced and kind of creative people. And so really, to answer your question, it feels to me like there's a lot of green fields for people working in this area of storytelling, people with skills from the film and broadcast and video game and theatre and all this kind of these industries to move into this area where we haven't really defined what these formats are. We don't really know where the technology is going to go, and therefore what experiences and what kind of experiences we'll be able to make for audiences in the future. And that's why it's a really interesting time to be in XR, right? You're seeing a lot of people, especially in the games, I guess, trying out new formats, trying out new modes of interaction. Like, I think even, locomotion, right? There's been about, let's say, 20 different kinds of locomotion in VR games over the past 15 to 20 years. And none of them are perfect for all kinds of games. And so there's a lot of experimentation. And that's just a really exciting time to be in an area where people are making experiences, because everything's new.
Well, David, thank you very much for joining the All Things XR podcast.
Thank you for having me.